welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm really delighted on today's program to welcome back into our studios James Nyber, who is a local author, particularly adept at writing on various aspects of pop culture, especially the movie business and great movie actors, past and present, and musical stars as well. And on today's program, we're going to be talking about what I assume is James Nyber's most recent book. It's the latest one I've seen anyway, and it's James Cagney, Films of the 1930s. And of course, many of us know the name James Cagney really, really well. And the 1930s is, of course, that first decade when Cagney made a name for himself as one of our most powerful, iconic actors. And it was just the beginning, of course, of a really stunning, impressive career. And in this book, James Nyber examines each and every one of the films that James Cagney makes, and charts for us also a period in time when James Cagney, with some disgust, turned his back on his own studio after realizing how much they were, in a sense, mistreating him, not appreciating him, and not paying him fairly. And James Cagney is probably one of the figures that really helped reshape the way in which Hollywood functions and the place that the actor has in that world, where once upon a time actors were really at the mercy of the studios and could be mistreated in all kinds of ways. That really started to change, and James Cagney's one of the reasons why. So there's a lot of history here, even beyond the specific films which James Nyber examines in really interesting fashion. And there's photographs, full cast lists, plot summaries, and a really interesting examination of this whole era of Hollywood and the life and legacy of the great James Cagney. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield. Again, it's James Cagney, Films of the 1930s. And James Nyber, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Okay, Greg.
Good to have you here. Glad that we can do this. I know I've asked you this before, but for the sake of anybody who might be listening who might have missed our previous conversations, I wonder if you would just sketch a little bit your own love affair with the movies and how that started.
Okay, well, it started when I was just a little five-year-old, right around the time, President Kennedy had been assassinated, and that pretty much took over the news waves. No 24-hour cable news channels back then. It's just the television stations we had. And the following, I believe, Saturday, they were showing just the funeral everywhere. And so my parents took us out to the movies, and it was my first movie. And as it turned out, it was Who's Minding the Store with Jerry Lewis. And I saw this huge screen, this packed theater, and the theaters were big and ornate back then, not concrete bunkers at the end of shopping malls. And at the first shot of Lewis, he's slurping a bowl of soup. And every time he does that, the whole audience just rocks with laughter. And they laugh just harder and harder throughout the movies. And my young mind realized that that silly guy up on the screen was making all these people happy at the same time during a very, very sad time. And I connected with that and connected with the power of film and the power of comedy. And as a little kid, I would, you know, when we'd go to the library in school, I would try to find books about film people, and especially funny ones, and see as much as I could. And eventually, by the time I was 16, I knew enough where I was writing articles for publication in film magazines.
We were just talking before we went on the air about how nowadays it is possible for just about anybody to access just about anything in the world of film, in the world of cinema. But when you first became enamored of movies, of course, it was a whole different world, and there were no such thing as VCRs or DVDs or DVRs or Netflix or any of that would make this world accessible.
So cars, heat, you know, we had nothing.
Right. So how did you as a film buff manage? I mean, what were the means by which you could drink in these films?
Well, it was the type of thing where it didn't, like, completely consume my life. I had a regular life of going to school and playing outside and all the rest. But during my spare time, it was sort of like a giant jigsaw puzzle where a book would come out on this guy, or you'd find something in the World Book Encyclopedia about a paragraph long about that guy. You would see the movies when TV planned to show them, sometimes way in the middle of the night, where I would set my alarm and sneak out of bed and watch the movie and sneak back into bed and go to school the next day. Little things like that, just because I was that fascinated to find out more. And in the early 70s, roughly, there was this big nostalgia boom where the college campuses suddenly embraced Groucho Marx and Humphrey Bogart and a few people that they chose to make icons. W.C. Fields is another. Their films became more hip, more accessible. People were talking about them, and they would sometimes, I was looking something up, and I saw a movie page from about 1972, and they advertised one of the current movies playing as, the greatest con man since the bank dick, referring to a 1940 W.C. Fields film. Well, you wouldn't see that today, but a new movie was promoted by using a reference to an older movie, because old films were that much a part of the mainstream culture all of a sudden.
Wow, a film from over 30 years earlier.
Yeah.
Wow. So in your days as a young movie fan, what's your recollection of your first encounter with the great James Cagney? Do you remember what your first Cagney film is that you saw?
Yeah, absolutely. There was this thing on Sunday nights on Chicago TV called When Movies Were Movies. And so already in the 70s, which was a very fertile and very strong period for film, they were already being nostalgic about, but back then. So I remember they had Channel 9 in Chicago, WGN, had a James Cagney week, and the Sunday night movie was a prison movie he made in 39, which is, of course, in my book, called Each Dawn I Die. It's James Cagney and George Raft. And I watched it, and I thought, now, I had known James Cagney from Yankee Doodle Dandy, because even if you never saw the movie, they still showed it every 4th of July, and you'd see a commercial of him out there dancing, the George M. Cohan dances and so forth. And so when I saw Each Dawn I Die, I saw this real hard drama, and I thought, that was good.
That's the one about the reporter who's framed and goes to prison, right?
Yes, exactly. And then the next night they ran Angels with Dirty Faces, which is an absolutely iconic film for Cagney, the walk to the electric chair, and the Dead End Kids, who I had already recognized as seeing them as the Bowery Boys, Pat O'Brien as the priest, and Ann Sheridan. It was really, an exceptional movie. It might be my favorite non-comedy film, and that's there's a lot of contenders. And then finally, the following night, it was Public Enemy, and by that time, I was more than sold, because they were showing his best work, and I connected with him. I really didn't venture too far outside of comedy, maybe some westerns, maybe some horror movies, when I looked at older films, because Jerry Lewis was the introduction, so I gravitated towards comedy, and that's what I've written about most. But somehow Cagney just connected, and I tried to see as much of his work as I could.
Wow. Well, this book is just fascinating. Again, it's called James Cagney Films of the 1930s. Ahead of us talking about his films, let's talk a little bit about where he was born and something about his childhood, because you make the point more than once in this book that that had something to do with who he was as an actor and the way in which he was really able to kind of emotionally and mentally access some of the film or some of the roles that he was asked to portray.
Well, essentially, Cagney was a song and dance man in vaudeville, a stage guy. And when he went into movies, they put him in a role as a gangster, and he was so good, they kept giving him those types of roles. And there were conflicts at the studio because he wanted to make musicals because he felt that was his forte. But he was particularly good as the tough guy. And the reason for that is, unlike someone like Humphrey Bogart, who was just good at playing one, or Edward G. Robinson, Cagney really was a tough kid from the streets. And so his past, his experiences, would inform the characters he played. Now, for Angels with Dirty Faces, he does the shoulder hitch where, you know, he hitches up his shoulders up and down. And forever, Impressionists, when they would do James Cagney, would do that particular mannerism. Well, Cagney said he got that off a street corner pimp from in the neighborhood when he was a kid, and he just added it to the character as, you know, to flesh out the character. So his past would inform those tough guy roles, and because he could connect that that completely, the performances were quite good.
I remember in your introduction about him, and so it's New York City where he grows up, right?
Mm-hmm.
A tough, tough neighborhood in New York, but you mentioned the fact that he was a really tough, formidable kid on the streets, but he was also a kid that more often than not was defending smaller kids. It's not so much that he was terrorizing the neighborhood, but more likely, more apt to be, in a sense, one of the good guys in a neighborhood like that.
Yeah, he was pretty much the bully's bully. And he was also, you know, he was a smaller kid, too. So whenever he would fight in a movie, his opponent would be a much bigger guy. And that would add some essence to his tough guy character.
Right. So exactly when did he break into show business? And that would have been with the vaudeville, right?
Yeah, he was on the vaudeville stage. He was in a play, and the play was brought to... purchased by Warner Brothers at the request of Al Jolson, who was at Warner at the time. He saw the play and liked it, and he told Warner, get the play and the couple of actors who are in it, which were Cagney and Joan Blondell. Well, when they made the movie version, they put Cagney in it, but not Joan Blondell. Joan Blondell they gave something else, and she later did a few films with Cagney and might be his best female co-star. Because they really connected together. But Cagney was good in the film, which was Sinner's Holiday, that came out in 1930. It's a smaller part, but he registers really well, to the point where the critics are singling him out in their reviews and saying, hey, you know, this new guy. So, and he did that a few times, and then Public Enemy came along, and that put him over the top as a star.
So the first film comes out in 1930. So,
right.
So when we're talking about the James Cagney movies of the 30s, we're talking about the very beginning of his movie career and this first decade. You know, I suppose sometimes when we're looking at a someone's career, it doesn't necessarily work out all that neatly to focus on such and such a decade, but I can kind of tell from reading this that there's a nice symmetry to this decade. I mean, and a lot happens, and he grows quite dramatically through the course of those 10 years.
Yeah, this is a very, very pivotal decade in Cagney's career where he made some of his best movies and where the Cagney that we understand and recognize is fleshed out. He continued working all the way up into the 60s and even made a comeback briefly in the 80s. But the films he made after the 30s, he had a little more clout and as a result had a little more choice. And even though his choices might have had some artistic understanding, they weren't really good box office. Like when he wanted to do the film version of the William Saroyan play, Time of Your Life, you know, that doesn't really hold up terribly well. Even though he got a great cast and they're great in it and a great writer, it just doesn't seem to come together as well as one of his tough, streamlined gangster movies. And, of course, he didn't abandon the tough guy altogether. White Heat was made as late as 1949, and that's a classic prison drama, gangster drama.
So when it comes to putting a book like this together, I assume a big part of what happens is that you sit down and you watch all of these films, even films that you've seen before. First of all, I assume that all of these films that you talk about are... still exist or are available to watch.
Oh yeah, the writing of a book, what you do is, well, what I do, I'm sure other people have different methods, but I watch the film. Often it's a movie I've seen a bunch of times, but having watched it for entertainment is different than watching it and having to assess it and write about it. And I watch the film, and then I pay attention to, like, the progression of his character, the different things he's doing, how he responds to different directors and their vision. I mean, a director like Michael Curtiz, who directed Angels with Dirty Faces, is much different than a guy like Lloyd Bacon, who directed Oklahoma Kid, or somebody like that, or Archie Mayo, who directed And he responds differently to different directors, and their visions are not all the same. And how his character progresses, and how he utilizes the same type of character, sort of like John Wayne. He established a persona, but he uses it in different contexts. And maybe an even better example is Clint Eastwood, who has a particular persona, but look at the different genres he's investigated. Besides Westerns and Dirty Harry, he's done things like Bridges of Madison County, which is much different than those types of movies, but he directed it, and he uses that persona in a different context. And that's what's interesting about Cagney. He had an established persona, but he used it in different contexts where sometimes he was the bad guy, sometimes he was the good guy, but that persona always was part of it. He had a great deal of charisma. Somebody once said, when he enters the scene, it's like a bunch of firecrackers all going off at once.
It's very well put. So were there any of these films in the 1930s that you had not yet seen?
No.
So you'd seen all of them at least once.
Yeah, they had been, these were major studio productions, and they had been around on TV on various late shows. And when I discovered Cagney, when I was talking about seeing him on Each Dawn I Die, I might have been 13 years old. And that, of course, was 2 or 3 years ago. So,
well, I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I'm on the other hand embarrassed to say that I have not seen any of these films start to finish. I've certainly seen a clip here and there, and I know who James Cagney is. But I think really the only James Cagney film I know I've seen start to finish and multiple times is Yankee Doodle Dandy, the famous film about George M. Cohen, for which I think he won an Oscar, you tell
he
us.
He did indeed. Now, that's understandable because your background is in musical theater, and so you're naturally going to connect to one of the classic films of musical theater about one of the great showmen of theater's past. But with me, I didn't connect to these movies because I grew up as a gangster, because I did not grow up in a tough neighborhood. I grew up in a very comfortable middle-class life in a very ordinary family with normal circumstances. The films open the window to an area of the past in the 30s when people were all disproportionately poor. There was a lot of more gang activity. People like John Dillinger and Al Capone were folk heroes. Especially someone like Dillinger, who's robbing from banks. Well, banks were foreclosing on our home, so good for you, Dillinger. And, so when Cagney plays Rocky Sullivan in Angels with Dirty Faces, he's a gangster, but the entire film shows that he's a gangster with a heart. He's bad because of these circumstances. He ends up going to the electric chair, but we end up loving him because he pretends to be frightened at the end just to save the dead-end kids at the request of the priest. And all that's going on at once, and so while they're glorifying the gangster, they're not glorifying gangland activity or crime. They're trying to understand and represent it.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with local author James Niebuhr, who's joined us a number of times on the morning show and joining us today to talk about his latest book, which is James Cagney Films of the 1930s. As we mentioned, it all gets started with a film called Sinner's Holiday, and you describe this as an inauspicious film debut for James Cagney. Why that choice of words?
It wasn't a very good movie itself. He stood out in it because, well, now we look at it in retrospect and we think to ourselves, well, that's James Cagney. It's his first performance. That's cool. But at the time, he was the thing that stood out. It's not a particularly, mind-blowing movie. The first really great movie he did was Public Enemy, which is about 3 or 4 movies down the road.
Right. One thing that you mentioned in the second film, you talk about The Doorway to Hell, which, again, he has a relatively small role.
Yeah.
There are other important actors in it. But one of the things you mention here is the method by which these early talkies were made. Long pauses between lines of dialogue, no music in the background, adds to the edgy effect this film still has in the 21st century. I'd never stopped to realize that, but that's true, isn't it? I mean, there is a certain kind of style to many of these early talking films that makes them, in a sense, stand out even before we've gotten to matters like the plot and the actual performances.
Well, there was a transition that was going on, of course, when they went from silent films to sound films. And Very early sound films, you'll see them walk over to a table to say their line because the microphone's in like the centerpiece and stuff like that. By the time they made Doorway to Hell, sound was improving a little bit, even though it was still fairly new. And with sound films in their infancy, they didn't have a lot of like musical background to enhance the scene, and they were still, you know, they weren't quite realizing that snappy dialogue has to happen and stuff. So when they would talk in these tones, when they deliver their lines and say it in this manner, it has sort of a stark realism that seems to bring us back to that particular time in filmmaking. And it also adds a certain edginess to the characters, as if every line seems somewhat threatening, due only to their sort of tentative delivery.
Mm. You mentioned that The Public Enemy is his first really big film. There are three ahead of that, including Other Men's Women. You mentioned the fact that in these films he has relatively little screen time, relatively little to do, and yet, at least in some cases, we can already sort of detect James Cagney's charisma. I suppose that's an important matter, that sometimes someone can have all the talent in the world, but if you're in a role where you don't get to display that at all, it may be that no one will notice and understand that you're capable of bigger and better things. Evidently, James Cagney was able to show something to somebody, even in these small roles, to warrant him being given bigger opportunities.
Well, he was given roles in movies. They had kept him busy. In those days, you didn't have the choices. You were talking earlier about the fact that you didn't have a lot of choice in the matter as an actor. You were hired by the studio. You worked. You got a regular salary. And they just kept putting him in roles, and he did what he could with them. And then when Public Enemy came along, he ended up really kind of blowing people away with the force of his character and the ability to pretty much carry a film that had a lot of good actors in it, and for him to stand out above and beyond their performances is pretty amazing. And some of the scenes, like pushing the grapefruit, the iconic scene of pushing the grapefruit in the woman's face, while that's an iconic scene because it's so shocking and so unsettling to see that sudden reaction, and especially for 1931, that was a pretty violent, angry action due to the woman.
So, we're talking now then about the film that made him a star, The Public Enemy.
Yeah.
And you call this one of the quintessential films of its time for several different reasons. And one of them, you say, it offers a level of artistic freedom that in the 1930s can only be found in pre-code movies. What do you mean by that, by pre-code movies?
In 1934, something got enforced called the production code, where that's when they started doing the whole, separate beds, you have to have one foot on the floor if you're sitting on a bed with a woman. All those kinds of things were, enforced at that time. And there were creative limitations, whereas in the early talkies, you'll hear, you'll see tougher guys that I guess the level of violence, the dialogue, it's just stronger and grittier. Something like I'm thinking while I'm talking that something like James Cagney pushing the grapefruit in May Clark's face might not have been allowed after 1934, for instance. The ending where Cagney, who plays Tom Powers, body is delivered to the doorstep of the home. The doorbell rings, they open up the door, and his body, with his eyes wide open, all wrapped up, comes falling forward. And that's how the movie ends. Well, that's just pretty ugly. But
right.
And they wouldn't be able to do that later on because censorship was a little more strict.
So if we want to see true brutality, I mean, showed in much more sort of frank fashion, we look to these really early films before the code went into effect.
The pre-code films were, the creative freedom was such that they didn't have any artistic limitations put upon them by people who thought they knew better for everybody else, basically. After the code set in, there were restrictions that didn't allow a lot of that sort of freedom.
we should probably just say a word about what this movie is about,
yeah.
And maybe specifically also highlight this scene, this famous scene that you just mentioned. But we might have listeners who've actually never seen that and might not understand. You know, some guy with a grapefruit. What's the big deal? In fact, it's a as you say, a shocking scene.
Well, I guess it's because we're somewhat jaded by the fact that 83 years of cinema has happened since Public Enemy, and we've seen a lot worse things in movies. But in 1931, when this sort of thing was a lot more shocking, Cagney plays a kid from a tough neighborhood who grows up to be a gangster, and he keeps making his way further and further up the ladder in gangland activity. Well, when he feels frustrated with his girl, frustrated with his life, frustrated with his situation, he's sitting angrily at the table with the actress's Mae Clark, and she's trying to say, pay more attention to me. It used to be like this, it used to be like that. And she starts off a line with, "I wish," and he interrupts her by saying, "There you go wishing again. I wish you was a wishing well, because I'd like to tie a bucket to you and sink you." And after 1934, a line that threatening and that like, whoa, wasn't likely allowed. Nowadays, much worse things are happening.
Sure.
But in the context of the time. And then she says, "Maybe you found somebody you like better." And then he looks at her and just suddenly, in this very still scene, he grabs a grapefruit off the table, pushes it into her face, and saunters away, and the scene fades. And at the time, that was so shocking that it's gone on and taken on a life as its own, where people who've never seen a James Cagney movie often know, oh, is that the guy that pushes the grapefruit in the woman's face? Because that scene became so iconic. Years and years later, Mae Clark was often asked what it felt like when the grapefruit was pushed in her face, and I had the pleasure of talking to her before she passed away and used it in the book. And when I asked her, she said, I said, "How did that feel?" And she said, "Wet."
You quote Jude Law as saying that James Cagney is where modern screen acting began.
You know, Martin Scorsese, when he was filming The Aviator, wanted people to understand the era a little bit better, so he showed Public Enemy to his cast, and that was Jude Law's reaction.
Wow. It's interesting that the film that follows that, the Public Enemy, made him a star, of course, but then came a film which had already been shot, but it was released right after, called The Millionaire, in which James Cagney has only one scene, but you tell us it's a really pivotal scene.
Yeah, the Millionaire is a film with George Arliss, who is completely forgotten today, but is had a certain amount of star quality back in the early 1930s. And this is more of a quiet drama about a rich man who doesn't have money and has to enter the workforce type of thing. And Cagney has one scene with him where he tries to, like, sell him something. It shows his charisma, his enthusiasm. And when he walks, he takes the scene completely away from Arliss. And it's that scene that completely wakes you up in the viewing of the movie. And he made that because after Public Enemy and before the next movie he was scheduled to be in, they didn't want him sitting around idle while they were paying him, so they just threw him in this movie in this short scene. And that's the type of thing that happened. He didn't audition for these roles. He didn't choose these roles. Back then, you worked for a studio. They said, "Here's your script," and you did that movie.
Yeah, next week you're doing this.
Yeah,
it or not.
Right.
Like it or not. You mentioned Joan Blondell as being one of his best co-stars and a movie called Blonde Crazy is evidently the first time that they have significant screen time together.
Yeah, well, she was in Public Enemy.
Oh, she was in Public Enemy.
Yeah, she was also in Public Enemy. But Blonde Crazy is good because it's a comedy, and they both have comedic skill. Joan Blondell's especially good in that area, and there's a great deal of charisma between them. Where one wishes they made more movies together, and because Joan Blondell continued acting, you know, well into the 60s. She's in one of the Elvis Presley movies I cover in my previous book. So,
you tell us that upon completion of Blonde Crazy, Warner Brothers had no work for Cagney, and when he demanded a salary hike, and they refused, Cagney then walked out and was then suspended. Tell us more about how significant this little moment was in Cagney's career.
It's one of many walkouts. This wasn't the, you know, exactly the biggest one.
Maybe the first?
Yeah, it was the first of many walkouts where he was the type to think, you know, I don't need movies. I can just go back on the stage. Who cares? So he would see, you know, that other actors were getting this much money and he was getting that much money. And he's like, well, my name's above the title just like theirs. So why am I not making this level? It really came more to a head when he saw lines wrapped around the block to go see Public Enemy. And he's thinking, you know, if my movies are making this kind of money for the studio, I should be getting a little bit bigger piece of the pie. Yeah, he was only getting a few hundred dollars a week in those days. And back then, that was more money than it is now. But it certainly wasn't the salaries. When you read about Robert Plant being offered $800 million to reteam with Led Zeppelin, you realize how much monetary value has changed as far as show business is concerned.
Right.
But with Cagney, he's making a few hundred dollars, and he could probably do better elsewhere, and he didn't care if he stayed in movies. So he decided to walk out. But then when Blonde Crazy and then another movie he made with Edward G. Robinson, Smart Money, were both hits, the Warner Brothers decided, all right, and they gave him more money for Taxi, the next movie.
And you mentioned that Taxi, the character that he plays in Taxi, in some ways runs a little bit parallel to the kind of figure that Cagney was in terms of a rabble-rouser trying to make things better for the little guy.
Yeah, it was interesting that after his walkout and his insistence on more money and the studio agreeing to do so, they put him in a movie where the script has him as a taxi driver who was going against ruthless companies trying to take over the town and put the smaller companies out of business type of thing.
Right. I think of all the films you talk about in this book, this is one of them that I really feel like I want to see. What a fabulous idea. What a fabulous idea for a story. You also mention, I think, that this is the film where he comes the closest to saying the line that everybody says he said. You know, when you do a Jimmy Cagney impression, you do the, you know.
Yeah, you dirty rat. Yeah, he never said you dirty rat, and he always stated to impressionists that he never said you dirty rat. But in Taxi, it comes close. It's something that, I don't know the exact line. I haven't.
Yeah, and I got it right here.
Okay.
Come out of there, you dirty yellow-bellied rat.
Yeah, that's as close. Yes.
Right.
Pre-code dialogue. That's as close as we get to James Cagney saying, you dirty rat.
That's interesting. In his next film, The Crowd Roars, he plays a race car driver. You tell us this is the first time he plays a character who, in your words, has hit the skids.
Yeah, he has hit the skids. In his previous films, Cagney was, the character was in control for the most part.
On the ascent,
yeah.
One way or another.
Whereas in The Crowd Roars, he's a race car driver whose friend is killed on the track and whose brother he doesn't want getting into racing, and he does, and he's going around with a woman, played Joan Blondell, who he doesn't want the brother to see, and things are just kind of getting away from him, and the death of the friend especially overwhelms him, and he starts drinking, and he's unemployable, he not even as a mechanic, and it becomes very difficult for him, and we see that descent and how he plays it. It was directed by Howard Hawks, a very great director, and it's not Hawks' best work or Cagney's best work, but it is nevertheless an interesting film because it's something of a harbinger to a similar type of rise and fall that he played in The Roaring Twenties, which is his last film of the 30s.
Well, in the next film, Winner Take All, he plays a down-and-out prize fighter, right?
What's interesting about that is he doesn't have the James Cagney voice in that. He doesn't talk, like that. He doesn't have that. He plays sort of a mug, and he talks sort of a mug-like character.
Huh.
So he affixes his voice differently. He tries to do something different with the character, which is interesting because it shows that he's getting tired of the consistent tough guy roles where the only thing that seems to change is the script. And even though he's developed and refined a screen persona in the John Wayne's Clint Eastwood manner, he wants to investigate what more he can do with the character. And so in that film, he does something with the voice, with the delivery.
That would be fun to see
and
to hear. In the next film, Hard to Handle, one of the things you mention is that this was the first film he made after that 6 month hiatus.
This is another walkout entirely.
Another
walkout entirely. Yeah, this time everybody was pretty much watching because he wanted more money. He wanted more creative control. He didn't want to keep making the same tough guy films, and Warner Brothers basically said, you know, you're ours, we pay you, and this is what you do. And he's like, okay, fine. And he did another walkout, and this was, lasted several months, but he stood his ground because there were other things he could do and other interests he had where he didn't need the movie business. But then when they realized that they needed him more than he needed them, they acquiesced to his demands once again. And a lot of Hollywood was like, well, you know, if you make these demands and, you know, you can get better treatment. Well, now movie stars will, you know, before they get on the set, they want, tens of millions of dollars ahead of time, and they want their own trailer, and they want a bowl of this kind of candy, and they want several drinks of this, and all these, you know, incredible demands, whereas James Cagney had to not work for 6 months in order to get a pay raise back in the 30s.
Well, and you make the special point, too, that he was able to secure that better deal at a time when, I mean, it's the Great Depression, and studios are cutting back. So the fact that he was able to secure a pay raise at this time, really says something about his potential, and that, you know, that they realized he was a very valuable commodity for them.
Well, people should realize that movies were very inexpensive entertainment back then. Even during the Depression, the one entertainment they could afford to get out of the house and see would be a movie. I mean, a ball game would be too expensive, but a movie, you could see them for 15 or 20 cents back in those days. And you'd see a double feature, a short comedy, a cartoon, a newsreel. You were at the movies all afternoon, sort of like TV, and it was, you know, so, and people were paying to see James Cagney. And so they couldn't afford to get rid of a guy that Depression audiences were paying to see.
Yeah. His next film is Picture Snatcher, in which he plays a gangster who, after getting out of prison, wants to become a photojournalist, which is a movie you tell us that's kind of an indictment of tabloid journalism, which was very powerful then. But I want to ask you about the film after that, The Mayor of Hell, which you said was a very controversial movie for its time. How so?
Well, it showed how terrible the conditions were in some of the juvenile prisons, where a group of kids go to prison, and Farina from the Our Gang comedies is one of the actors, and Frankie Darrow, a very famous child actor, is in there, and they go to this prison, and there's a warden who, it's surrounded by barbed wire, and there's beatings and whippings, and they're fed just, you know, food that was terrible, whereas the warden is eating bacon and eggs and so forth. And then Cagney gets hired and comes in to do an inspection. And he didn't really think he was gay. He just wanted to come in and out and just, you know, don't worry about it. And then he saw some of the conditions, and having grown up in the streets himself, the character he played, he decided to change things. So he made arrangements with connections he had, political connections he had, to overthrow the current warden, and he turned the prison into something that the kids could achieve. Like, there was education, there were workshops, there was ways to learn a trade, the food was better, the barbed wire was taken down, and the kids who were tough and dirty and angry and nasty started to evolve into being able to trust each other and trust authority and, you know, have an interest in achieving. And then Cagney, of course, gets in trouble and has to shoot a guy, and so he has to hide out, and the old warden comes back and makes up for lost time. And it's really because of such of an indictment on the juvenile prison system, investigations started to happen to actual juvenile prisons because of this movie. The same thing happened with a movie called I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang with an actor named Paul Muni, which showed the adult prison systems, and that changed the prison laws in several states. Well, wow. Mayor of Hell had that same impact on juvenile prisons.
Wow. Interesting that he went from that to a musical called Footlight Parade.
He fought and fought to make a musical, and they finally gave him one, and it was really great.
Right, and it sounds like it's an interesting story that kind of is part of its time about how talking movies really affected the performance of live music.
Right, exactly. People could see musicals at the movie theater for 20 cents, so why pay a few dollars to see something on Broadway or on stage? And what Cagney decided to do is, the Cagney character decided to do, is to create a bunch of short musical performances to show before feature films. But that meant driving an entire cast on a bus from theater to theater while it changed and so forth. And but the musical numbers, like By a Waterfall and Shanghai Lil, in which Cagney sings and dances on screen, they're really quite strong. The movie is very fast-paced, real sharp dialogue, really funny. Cagney's there, Joan Blondell is there, Ruby Keeler is there, and Dick Powell. And it's one of the strongest musicals of the 1930s, and it made a lot of money, and people really enjoyed it. But he got shunted right back into the tough guy roles right after that.
Several films later is Here Comes the Navy, the first time that he is opposite Pat O'Brien, someone that would be an important screen partner of a sense.
He's a personal friend of his. He knew him on stage in the stage years, and they finally made a movie together. And whether they were buddies or adversarial, they always had an enormous charisma to play off of each other.
And it's in this film that you mention, you quote Gloria Stewart. She's the actress who was decades later was nominated for a Sporting Academy Award for Titanic, but she's in this film, and she mentions the grueling work schedules and talks about how that's one of the reasons why she and James Cagney and other actors worked to create the Screen Actors Guild.
Yes, exactly. It was a union because they would have you working. Well, right now I'm writing a book on the Mickey Rooney films, and Mickey Rooney was working on one of the Andy Hardy movies while he was filming Boys Town. Judy Garland was going into Babes in Arms, a big musical, and finishing up Wizard of Oz, another huge production that everybody knows. So that's the sort of thing that was happening with all the actors in those days. And so in the 30s, a lot of the actors were just utilized. They would bicycle from set to set in order to do films. Some of the smaller actors who had supporting roles would be working on two or three movies at a time.
I'm glad that you spend time to talk even about the misfires, such as, for instance, a film version of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, in which he plays Bottom, is that right? And you pull no punches in saying he's badly miscast in this film, but it's probably an interesting thing to see.
Is interesting to see people like Joe E. Brown, a young Mickey Rooney, James Cagney, and so forth, appearing in a Shakespearean production. And it was directed by Max Reinhardt, who had directed the Hollywood Bowl version that inspired Warners to decide to make this movie. Mickey Rooney was on stage in the Hollywood Bowl production, and so was Olivia de Havilland, and they were both hired to be in the movie. Olivia de Havilland ended up with a pretty good career at Warner Brothers. She's still alive today. I mean, in 1930s she was working. She was, of course, in Gone with the Wind.
Right.
And she's still living today.
James Cagney continues to have his frustrations with Warner Brothers to the point that he leaves Warner Brothers for a time and makes a couple of films for a much, much smaller studio, a Grand National, which doesn't even exist anymore.
Of all the things that the major stars did back in the 30s, that is probably my favorite, the most fascinating one of all. He had a clause in his contract in which he was to always get top billing. That's part of his contract. Something about he drove by a movie marquee for his movie Ceiling Zero, in which it said Pat O'Brien, James Cagney, Ceiling Zero. he took a photograph, showed it to Warner Brothers, and said, "Yep, see what's happening? Is it now?" And that was a violation of his contract. So he left Warner Brothers, and he went over to a small-time studio. They called it Poverty Row because over on Sunset and Gower Streets, there were small studios in that area that produced cheap, aggressive movies for, you know, quick consumption. And while B-movies are low-budget, they're not bad movies. A lot of times, there was a lot of great talent in those movies, and they had sort of a, you know, visceral interest for even today. A lot of them have held up, and some great directors and actors came out of those films. But Cagney, much differently, didn't start there and rise up. He went from a major studio to a B-movie studio that specialized pretty much in Tex Ritter westerns. Tex Ritter was a cowboy star, the father of John Ritter from the old Three's Company show. And Cagney went there, and they gave him more creative control. He could pretty much choose his stories and so forth. And the first film he made there was a movie called Great Guy, in which it seems like, you know, kind of a silly idea for a movie now, but back then I guess there was some controversy in the news where grocers were adding extra weight when they would weigh meats and vegetables and stuff, and they were bilking people. And Cagney was an investigator with the government who went around checking these things and catching people at it. Well, there were gangsters behind all that were profiting from it, so he gets mixed up with them. But what's interesting is that it's, while it's still a tough James Cagney, he's not the tough James Cagney that we know from earlier films. He's not so quick to fight. When he gets jumped and beat up, rather than go after the guys one by one, like he would in a Warner movie, he calls the police and reports it. Things like that. And even though he stands up to everybody and he's still the James Cagney we love, he's not the exactly the same in the way he approaches and responds to conflicts as in other movies. He's very much a good guy in this one. May Clark is back with him, his old buddy from Public Enemy, and also was in the movie later, Lady Killer, earlier. She's in there with him, and he's got a decent cast. And the movie was, you know, a low budget, and turned a really good profit. It was a hit because Cagney was a star. It did have one problem, and that's the major studios pretty much owned a lot of theater chains. So, and when somebody walks out on a major studio, the other major studios are like, up. And they didn't really like having the low budget studios pictures in their theaters. Unless it was like, okay, as a second feature. Our movie's the big main feature, and then the extra feature is this low-budget one. Well, James Cagney was too big of a star to be in a second feature. He's, you know, the first feature. And so they had to rely on playing neighborhood theaters that weren't owned by any chain. Well, they could still turn a profit in those days that way. However, their next project was going to be Angels with Dirty Faces, the original story by Roland Brown, was given to Grand National to make for Cagney. And they were going to go with that one, but Cagney wanted to make a musical first. So they made something called Something to Sing About, a musical that went over budget, and the neighborhood theater thing wasn't enough to recoup that budget. And as a result,